The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
For those of you joining us for the first time, this is a podcast where we speak to fellow writers of literary fiction about their process and technique.
And this episode's guest is DBC Pierre, who joined us at the start of March in 2021 when we were all still locked down, being kept away from the general public.
Hopefully you're listening to this wherever you are, free and outside, or free and inside, somewhere other than your house.
We were joined by DBC Pierre just as he had put the finishing touches, the first draft of a non-fiction work that he's been working on during lockdown, where he's been writing about risk. He is the author of the novels Vernon Godlittle, for which he won the Booker Prize in 2003, Ludmilla's Broken English, Lights Out in Wonderland, Breakfast with the Borgias, and most recently, Meanwhile in Dopamine City. Which led to some of the themes that we began by talking about, didn't it?
Yeah, we sort of started on, following on from the theme of risk into the spread of social media and the damage that living your life through metrics and likes and so on.
The perils of infinite doom scrolling. Yeah, it was just a very interesting chat, I think, about which we start off with a slightly pessimistic view about where technology might be leading us if we don't grab it by the scruff of its neck. But just a very interesting look into his writing approach and what he's been up to. So without any further ado, DBC Pierre. You said when we were arranging this meeting that you were just finishing off some writing. What sort of stage are you at?
I just delivered a first draft, so literally in the last day or so.
Of a novel.
That wonderful. No, it's not. It's a non-fiction work called Little Snake, and it's an inquiry into risk, which includes not only gambling, but the mad mathematics of life. So it's been a really, really sweet job to do in the last year of the apocalypse.
And has the sort of time frame that you've been working on it kind of matched with the lockdown?
100%. It was pitched just before March last year, and originally was going to be a much shorter deadline. So I started off in earnest and at speed. And then, of course, during the 3 or 4 months that followed the initial lockdown, it became clear that things weren't going to be beer and skittles for a while yet. And so the publishing schedule moved back, and I've had the whole year to think about it, which is great because it's been a work of thought and reflection. And it's a little bit of a different job than a novel, which can and does drive itself in a certain way. And this one, you know, you really had to go back and answer some philosophical questions. So it's been a perfect way to spend this time. And I've just lobbed it in. I have no idea. I mean, more recently in the last few years, I have less and less idea when I finish a book, whether it is worthwhile at all for anyone else. And the same for this one. So, you know, I'm in that beautiful limbo before hearing where it could be utter shit, or it could be wonderful, or it could be something in between. And, you know, for me, I like it, and it ticked my boxes, so we'll wait and see.
So all being well with that, then, is that you'll start working with an editor on the first draft, or will it sort of come back with notes for you to work on? What's the usual drill with that?
Well, this one is for a wonderful new imprint called Cheerio, and I know the people involved, and this will come back. This will come back with a conversation. I don't know that we will yet get to an actual line edit, but essentially, once I know how the major play of it works for them, then it's an easy matter for me to polish it up. I like to polish my own stuff up so it can still sparkle, but you know, I've sent it in before actually line editing it, and we'll see what happens.
Has it changed a lot over the course of the year from the initial pitch? Did you have much leeway to go in different directions?
I had total leeway with this, which is great, which actually at the same time can be difficult. You have to pick a starting point, and because it's on a theme from life or a philosophical theme, it really could have gone anywhere. So nothing is suggested in terms of structure and form of the thing. And I don't know, we'll see. It was plenty of leeway anyway, and it's been a good exercise.
Is it quite sort of essayistic, or is it sort of research intensive, the writing of it? Or?
No, it's completely essayistic, and it has some memoir flooded through. Unfortunately, I've only got my own experiences to add, but some of them are pretty cool. And I've done some gambling in my time. So it is threaded in between some experiences, and I've taken those as a starting point to then think on about the madness of fortune and mathematics. Mm-hmm. And how actually by the end, and this was the thrust of it, I think, by the end, there are some mathematical and physics theories which are being used as platitudes now, which we just kind of accept, like probability and psychology as well. We've got the current cosh is confirmation bias, which we're seeing everywhere, where basically whatever you think, it's a confirmation bias, and that's why you're wrong. And actually, when you really look at it, the greatest example of confirmation bias is people finding confirmation bias everywhere. And likewise, probability, when you actually look at it, is a very slippery law. And of course, it depends on the length of the sample. And we're living our lives according to these things. Like, okay, you have a 71% chance of dyeing your hair at least once during a lifetime. Apparently, one in two of us will suffer a mental illness during our lifetime. And, of course, the sample is our whole life. And the only way we're going to know if the rule pays out is if we fall mentally ill or we die. And so after our deaths, we will be able to confirm that law was correct. And this really started me thinking, do you know what? We're living by a lot of bullshit as well, in terms of it's a quick way to just go, okay, this is good for you or it's not good for you. But you know, to say 30% of us are going to experience a certain thing across a sample as long as our lifetime is kind of pointless, because today I might do the thing which cuts that risk by half, which increases it by half anyway. So I've had a lot of fun with that, just trying to get real and trying to assess what is, because there's a lot of magic, especially after you've lived a few decades, things like coincidence become much more interesting. And of course, there are many, many more touch points. There are many more variables and factors in your life which can be subject to really extraordinary coincidences. And you have more elements, more pixels can join into coincidences. And it just occurs to me that there really is some magic going on. But we write a lot of opportunities off according to these old chestnuts of probability and what's likely and what's not likely. And the news unfolds. We're living through this century of science. And I'm completely a believer and an enthusiast of science. It's gotten into partnership with media, and we're just under this constant cosh every day, where 3 out of 5 people who eat bacon and 2 out of 4 people who do this and 1 out of 6. And you know, but just a single newspaper will give you about 8 different chances with odds of things that may or may not happen, depending on what you do. And it leads to what I've just in the last day identified as blockbuster video syndrome, for anyone who was around in the 90s. You know, where you walk into the video store to find a fabulous movie, you browse about 1,000 of them and walk out with nothing because it's pointless. It's impossible to choose anymore.
I think it still works with Netflix, to be honest. And it can be updated for millennials. Yeah, I reckon. It's the same thing. You sort of spend an hour just going, nope, 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 nope.
Isn't it weird? You see all the brain chemistry. I've been fascinated with this, but there is neuropsychology coming to bear on all these things, and this is going to be the century of it for sure, just looking at how we're reacting as groups now with social media and stuff. We're clearly completely under the auspices of brain science in terms of many things we do.
I think so, yeah, very consciously. When they're talking about the invention of infinite scroll and just how that makes you a complete slave to it. So what I'm interested in your thoughts on this then, because obviously your most recent novel, you sort of dealt with someone coming to social media through kind of external pressure as well. So are you quite a skeptic of its ability to do anything positive for us?
It's a neutral, it would be a neutral force. My problem with it, and the basis for Meanwhile in Dopamine City, the novel, my entire problem is that it is a surveillance device and we are not the client. So we are not Facebook's client and we are not Twitter's client. We are not Google's client anymore. We are the herd and the clients are elsewhere. And but for that fact, I think these would be amazing things and should have been amazing. We should be now on the threshold of a real liberation. All the human ideas are set and bubbling by themselves. We've decided it's too late now for racism. It's too late now for sexism. All these very, very pertinent issues have arisen. And unfortunately, what they're mostly doing is feeding the masters of social media. They're not being resolved because social media selects for discord and selects for disagreement and upvotes stuff that because it increases traffic. And so, I mean, even Facebook's own research has pointed out that the algorithm is actually selecting for disharmony because it's profitable. And under the circumstances of that, then it becomes tragic because I think a lot of good could have been done, but it needs to be jigged a different way. It needs to be jigged in a way that doesn't make us want to just say bugger off to all these mad voices that come out of there, you know. It's selecting for that 6% of people who should never be listened to. And there is a constant population of those people, unfortunately. We also form a revolving population of them. And I know, you know, for much of my life, I shouldn't have been listened to, and that could still be true. But there is a core population who we shouldn't listen to particularly much. And unfortunately, they're now running that game. So no, I'm pessimistic under the current system.
It does seem kind of intractable how to get out of that without, because I guess there's a sort of another model of social media in say China or something where you do get rid of any voice that's not going with the
it's true. Well, it depends who runs. Listen, it's about the masters. These should belong to us, and there are projects out there that we need to get behind who are doing this without surveillance and are doing it genuinely for the benefit of freedom of speech, etc. But you're absolutely right. Of course, it depends who the master is, and be it a government or an extreme billionaire, they pretty much have the same interest, which is to funnel things in their benefit.
You were talking earlier about the sort of the statistics, the science, the pseudoscience that says, you know, 3 out of 5 people are going to eat bacon today, and that sort of fake quantification of things. I think that and the way you use social media, the number of likes is kind of the first thing you often see. And before any message, really, it's oh, this has been retweeted however many times, or that is such an integral part of using the platform that it's about the numbers and the quantification of it rather than any kind of human conversation, which it seems hard to imagine how to get out of that. Well, how Twitter or Facebook or any of these platforms are going to get out of it, because their whole model is built around exactly that, getting the numbers up to, you know,
it's profitable. Yeah, it's profitable. I mean, they are, for that reason, chaos machines. And there is an extraordinary sense, which is also very funny for somebody who writes black comedies, but there's an amazing sense at the time we are at the moment in history that we were all literally born yesterday, that in fact no old values have any value at all, and that really anything can be reinvented from scratch. And it comes down, I think, largely to metrics, and especially those little tweaks. And the man who invented the like for Facebook is mortified. And there are some interviews, look up some interviews with him. But what seemed like a nifty idea at the time, he said, absolutely is going to destroy society.
The more it's kind of splits between these sort of, it's sort of based on science, but these sort of statistics that are thrown out, they're actually really quite divorced from actual science. You know,
yeah.
To put it in context in a scientific way, you'd need several papers referencing 20 more papers, and then you could understand what that statistic means. But memified on a social network, it means less than nothing. It's actually can be quite damaging to just.
It's true, and also the apples and pears. I mean, of course, we respond again. It's brain chemistry. You know, if something's received 30,000 hits or views or likes, then it is popular, and we are nothing else if not social creatures that run with the herd, and we'll do that automatically. Social proof means that 30,000 views cannot be wrong, and we go with it. And, you know, if it ends up being Hitler, then that's the way we're going. And this is kind of what happens. But, you know, it's also comical because if you go shopping, you'll find that SpongeBob season 2 has more stars than some works of Shakespeare. And on one hand, I completely get that. I like SpongeBob. And you go, well, yeah, actually, you know, I'd rather right now watch SpongeBob than read Shakespeare. But it's not about that. And, you know, one of my arguments with this whole system is that as fun as it is, it has reduced some incredibly sophisticated and nuanced human senses of value to nothing, to where an apple is equal to a pear. And unfortunately, the whole digital world runs on through traffic. So there is no such thing really as a bad tweet or a good tweet. They need the tweet. It's equal value to the algorithm. And, you know, that, well, we're seeing where it's going, and it's a hell of a ride. But until we correct that, I'd say we're in for some ugly times ahead.
It's such a steep learning curve, though, isn't it? Because you just think, like, 10 years ago when Facebook was a way of, like, oh, we can, you know, keep in touch with some people from school that you haven't seen for a while, and then you just have no idea what the sort of Pandora's box that's being opened with all of these things.
Well, that's it. Yeah, it's all secret. It is a cool idea. I would love to be on all of these things. I mean, they're cool ideas, but they needed to be for us and not solely for profit. We need to find somebody who's happy to have just $1 billion and not $100 billion. And apparently they're very, very hard to find.
Yeah, I mean, that's in terms of the statistics, that's what we've been hearing during lockdown, isn't it, with Jeff Bezos's fortune and Elon Musk as well, I guess. People sort of illustrating that if you spent X number of tens or hundreds of thousands of pounds a day since the year zero BC, you still wouldn't have spent through that much. And it's true.
Having said that, I'm going to say Elon Musk is exempt from any argument because he's expanding classical physics and not thieving our behavior as data. He's welcome to that. But and likewise, I mean, Jeff Bezos is a shopkeeper essentially, and obviously there are many sub arguments to that, but the sole aim wasn't initially to steal our behavior and sell it to unknown third parties.
I saw a fascinating interview with him in like 1996 or something, when he, because I mean, originally it was obviously set up as a online bookshop, and
I remember when it was a bookshop. It was a cool idea.
And he's very kind of geeky, and he just talks about the number. It's basically all about numbers, and bookshops can only hold X number of titles, whereas he can get a warehouse, and the number of titles that are available at any time to within a postal area, he can, you know, increase by X amount, and, you know, he can then create a business selling books. And the interview is very dismissive, sort of, well, So you're creating this online business. Do you see much future in that, or is it just a temporary project for you? It's going to be big.
Yeah, it's funny. No, I know he's a big fan of metrics, and it, you know, they have served him very well. But you know, the human factor is the one that gets argued about across all of these businesses. That's now seeped into mainstream business, where people are being tracked in their work and tracked in their toilet breaks and their lunch breaks and who they're talking to and what they're saying. And there are now algorithms starting to run companies according to metrics. And that just seems like a way to lose our humanity. The beauty of us, and the beauty as writers, you will appreciate as well, is how paradoxical and whimsical and how original we are when a moment arises that we have to find a new way or do something out of the box, or when we do it spontaneously. These things, the kind of lateral selection of our free actions, kind of sacred. And of course, that all gets lost when we're just running to numbers.
So if we go back to sort of old technology, as it were, I wonder if we could sort of just talk a bit about your writing process and how you begin. Are you a sort of a large-scale sort of note-taker when you're developing an idea and things like that? Or do you sit down and just get going?
I do take notes. I take notes throughout. I do that. I used to do that anyway before I was a writer, especially quotes from people that you just wing, you know, in a pub or something. You have some fabulous pieces of English.
Would you take that down there and then in a pub?
I have boxes. I have boxes full of old fag packets and bits and scraps of paper and matchboxes and stuff, which just have scribbled quotes on them dating back decades. I mean, they've never been used, but they're just different ways of seeing things and stuff that was important at the time. So it does carry into writing. Very often the starting point for these books that I've written will be on a single note somewhere.
Do you know at the time when you take that note, do you know that this is the start of a novel, or is it only in retrospect?
Oh, well, no, it has legs. But the thing is, I have so many notes. Literally every, I only drink so once or twice a week, but if I'm having a drink, I'll get a bunch of ideas. Thing is, I have enough notes, I can end up with, you know, a dozen or two dozen notes at the end of a week. I'll know which ones have legs for something.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because just one of the, once they're written down, I think this is key. When you write something down on paper, you make it exist. And we literally think about it. It sounds ridiculous, but we change the universe. We literally alter the structure of everything by writing down an idea, and it becomes manifest and concrete, and it changes its nature. And strangely, certain notes that I end up with, one of them will attract another subnote and another subnote, and that one will stay around the desk and he will spawn more notes, and you find that they're like cells. So the vast majority just pass through and they're funny ideas or gags or whatever. But some of them multiply like cells and start growing more stuff. And they're the ones that prompt me then to open a document. I just open the document and title it with something, and I put the contents of the note in there. And the document will start growing. And then suddenly your brain starts filtering things in a different way. It starts filtering things towards that idea. And you see things that apply to that idea. Just like if you buy your first Volvo, you suddenly see Volvos everywhere on the street. That little thing happens with the ideas we work on for a book, I think. And once we've written it and opened the document, then dialogue we hear, things we hear start to move the idea of that book. And I love that process. So, you know, I don't have to invent the thing from scratch. The life starts building it by itself.
It's still this a quite intangible thing before the document gets started, but your brain is still telling you that fits or that doesn't fit. You've already started to get, there's something, yeah, really hard to nail down. It's the yeah, it's the right character for it.
And you can get very, very disparate ideas that change your own mind as well, that work back on you. You think, well, wouldn't it be weird if that character went into this idea? And that expands your mind to new possibilities.
Is it mainly sort of plot or conceptual notes you're taking to begin with, or is it a mix? Like you mentioned, taking quotes from conversations in a pub or wherever to get this sort of feel of it. But in terms of the other notes, are you sometimes writing out a whole paragraph of sort of finished prose, or are you writing feelings, textures, the more abstract concepts as well, or is it more, oh, this character could do X, Y, Z, and that's the sort of nucleus at the start?
Everything. Rarely I'll get a paragraph of prose. They tend to just be scribbles. They're the type of things, basically what's happening, and you'll know this as well as writers, but basically what happens is that the work doesn't get left behind when you leave the desk. And so although I'm out and I've always taken ideas, written stuff down just because it's cool and you see little things, I'll literally just scribble 3 or 4 words to remind myself what I was looking at. But once some kind of work is underway, it doesn't stay on the desk. It travels with you. And so all that happens is once you begin working on something, then the notes you're taking are ideas that you had, which had you been at the desk would have gone straight into the book. Once you're working on something, and the same happens with sleep, the subconscious, I guess, will toss up ideas that we need and toss up little fragments and solve problems. You know, when I go to sleep, if I'm in a book, if I need something extra, I'll always tell myself to find it overnight. And it's amazing how often you can wake up next day without even a eureka moment, but you'll go straight to the page and solve that problem and move on. The brain, it's a bit like a puppy dog, I figured. You know, we have to train it. Keep some treats in your pocket and make sure it's walking alongside, you know.
And do you give yourself, when you're working on that first draft period, do you give yourself a set sort of time frame in which you want to have a kind of coherent first draft, or do you just sort of get it, it's there when it's there?
Yeah, no, I do. I use my patented delusion drive, which is I recommend for anyone who wants to finish a novel. And what I do every single time, actually, is say, yeah, I'm going to knock this off like Bukowski in 3 weeks, writing as fast as I can this first draft. And so I set off, and at the end of 3 weeks, when I'm not finished, I give myself an extra week, and I keep doing that for 2 more years. And it works every time. And by the end of 3 weeks, you've got hopefully too many words to go back or to give up, and then you just have to keep deluding yourself that it's almost there until it is. And one day it gets there.
Do you have a clearly defined, right, I'm starting the first draft moment when you've got enough notes, there's enough of a mass that you say, right, tomorrow or today I'm starting that 3-week burst, or does that just sort of come about?
I try to avoid too many hard entries. I'm also interested with the notion of exit velocity, the extra energy we need to begin something compared to merely furthering something which is already underway, and especially the psychology of, I have to trick myself because of my psychology. And so what I tend to do, if I've got an idea with legs, I open the document and put the idea in there, and I have a folder of unwritten books which are single documents titled and have the original idea. Some have a few more notes in them, and then over time some gather more notes than others and get a bit of a critical mass. But it means that for me to start a first draft, I have to make no particular decision because the document's already open. So I don't need exit velocity. It's already kind of underway. Mm. And I can just slide in there. Just for me, the less things in my life that I can make feel like a big plunge from scratch into something, then the easier things will go. You know, having said that, there are times when I say, this is it. But most of the work of that moment is actually to remind myself not to pay too much attention, because most of what I will write in first draft is crap. And so not to take it too seriously, not to stop, not to look back. What I want, first of all, is a page count of anything, because that will boost me along. And anyone who's writing for the first time, you know, do not get stuck on page one. It's lethal, and you'll be disheartened, and you can lose the will to do it. Just write forward, even if it's nonsense. Keep writing forward, because I've still found stuff comes out in some measure. The mud will have gems in there somewhere. But after a while, you've got 50, you've got 100, you've got 200, 300 pages just by going forward. And once you've got 300 pages, you've got something to work with. And you can say that you have written a novel. Don't show it to anyone, of course. But then really guiltily and shamefully spend some time correcting it and making it fabulous. And that kind of works out as well.
I think there's a lot to be said about that, you know, the paralysis or being intimidated by the blank page. But as sort of kind of obvious as it seems, the sort of saying about you can't edit a blank page is really, really holds a lot of water, you know?
Yeah, it's just easier. The problem is, and especially, I mean, we have to be a little bit conceited to imagine that we're going to sit and write a book. And it seems to me that some people will be deflated by the first things that they write down. I was, anyway. Where you think, okay, that's crap. That's clearly not a book that anyone's going to read. But if I can stick with it and get enough words, in fact, it can be improved and improved, and it can still go anywhere that we want. And also we will find that the lucky dip factor, that in fact, I guess our subconscious has added important stuff even to the nonsense that we've written, which we can extract and work with. And it's just much, much easier to improve something than to originate something wonderful from scratch. Yeah. For mere mortals anyway, of course, you know, some people will sit down and do that, but I think they're very rare. Even Hemingway used to drive himself crazy to express himself completely. So yeah, getting words down, becomes more important than what the words are, for me anyway, in the first instance. And I do find that it more or less, it heads the way that I want anyway, kind of, you know.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Unsound Methods. We hope you're enjoying the show. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Methods or view our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk.
There's that process of moving forward that actually you find the story really only starts in chapter 7? Or is the concept more or less set by the time when you're starting the draft that you know chapter 1 is going to be chapter 1 through whatever changes?
I should say most books change, and some of them change radically. The first novel, Burn a God Little, that stayed pretty intact. That first paragraph especially was the first thing written, which is another way to go about it, having told you not to get stuck on page one. But that came relatively easily. But I liked the first paragraph sufficiently that it became the standard for the rest of it. And so if things got any worse further down the track than that first paragraph, I would cut it and start again. And so I would lift things up to that. But that was unusual. Yes, generally speaking, you're right that, as somebody said, we should start a novel as near to the ending as we can. So if it's a plane crash, we need to start with the aircraft already in a dive on the first page. In that sense, yeah, you can, you know, I find that I can write some chapters which either get shifted to the middle or get reconstituted or get taken out, for sure. But that's the fun of it. Part of the thing is I never know where the book will go. And you will know that characters, especially in a novel, have their own natures. And as they grow, they will go places that they, by nature, go, which we can't anticipate. And so every book is a voyage of discovery for me. And it can be at the very end of the book before I know what is actually going on, before the big picture becomes apparent. And then I have to go back and line the whole thing up to fit that bigger picture. And that did kind of happen with Vernon, especially that didn't actually include the high school incident all the way up to about the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks of writing, because I couldn't see it in there. There was one mentioned like on the news and that was it. And it became clear that actually, no, he was reacting to all that. And I had to go back and build the whole thing again. But it took me that long to discover what was trying to be written or what I was trying to do. But it keeps it fun for us, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some writers that do seem to follow the sort of screenwriting concept of knowing what all the acts are and what the sort of beats are. And I feel like, yeah, if you're then sort of joining those dots, you need to discover where it takes you and let it and have the flexibility to lead you somewhere else. I mean, I guess it works for some people, but...
Yeah, we should make clear that it's easier with literary fiction, which can go absolutely anywhere, than, for instance, a spy novel in which there is a defined best way for that to go. And I fully understand if you sit down with a genre novel fully formed in your mind, then there is one best way to do that. Then the skills are slightly different. And that could also be a great relief, actually, to know exactly what you have to do and just make it as good as you can. But I haven't tried that.
So generally you don't, I mean, as you've written through the novels you've published, has your approach changed? Have you had more of an idea of where it's going from the start?
Yeah, I know what to take account of. And so I know where any movement is likely to come from. You know, it's just, I know the beast a little bit better. I am probably the beast in that equation. I do get a sense of not how it might change, but A, that it may change, and B, roughly, the form that could take and what that will mean. So I know before I've invested too long, I know to look out for markers that what I'm doing is worthwhile in any sense at all. So I don't invest 300 pages in complete nonsense. I always call it starting the engine. And the only difficult part of the book is when you still don't really have an idea of what you're doing, which is proper beginning of a first draft where you've got your idea, but it's like, well, where does that start? You know, is the protagonist on the street? Is he in a shop? Where do we find him at the beginning and where does he then go and why is he there? Those things are subject to change. You do have to make a judgment call where that is. And if after a while the engine doesn't run, I mean, there comes a point where it drives itself and where you're interested to see what can happen next, or you wonder what could possibly happen because you've left it in an impossible position, then the engine of the thing is running and it has interest. If it makes me wonder, then it will also make a reader wonder what's going to happen. So you have a sense of how it might move. I used to, and I still do at a certain point early on, it will assemble in my mind. I'll have an idea roughly of how it will go all the way up to the end. And I've gone to varying lengths to write big plans. I've even plotted like big Excel spreadsheets of plots and subplots and stuff about exactly what would happen. And that's useful, although I almost immediately then completely depart from it and never, ever look at it again. But I'm presuming that going through that exercise has at least written off one avenue that I won't be going down.
Yeah, I'm sure just laying it out like that once and going through it is...
You just have to know it intimately is the other thing. And the more messing about we do, people think, oh, my God, I've rewritten this chapter 800 times and it's hopeless. And actually it's not, because the more intimately we get to know the thing, by the end you know how roughed up we can be. We're really adhered and we're in a fever with the work because we've just sat with it for so long or through such ups and downs. And knowing the thing intimately is a great thing. And at very worst, anyone who is struggling or who has written the full length and can't see any point to it, just going back and back and back, does eventually make it very pliable, I find.
Yeah, I mean, if it feels like it's a real, such a trial to go back and do it, it's probably a sign that there's some things you need to iron out, I would guess. I mean, I've felt it myself. I'm not saying it, but it is where you really, yeah, shake out the stuff that you cannot bear to carry on working.
Yeah, it's horrible that. Yeah, that's when I start making all the paragraph endings line up on the page and stuff like that. And literally, you see, if you ever see an absolutely perfectly manicured page from me, that means that at some point it wasn't going well.
So actually with that, with the formatting, and this is probably something you've been asked before, so apologies for that, but with the two column structure that you have in parts of Meanwhile and Dopamine City, when you were writing that yourself, I don't know if you use sort of Word or something like that, how closely were you trying to sort of typeset that at the same time? Were you bearing in mind what an actual page of a novel in terms of formatting and proportions would be?
100%. And I had to. Yeah, it was written in Microsoft Word using columns. And especially now, the columns had two functions. The one down the left is narrative, and that's continuous, and that can spill, that can begin and end wherever it likes. The column on the right applies only to that page and is a news feed. And those columns in particular, a single comma or a full stop extra would make it go over the page. Mm-hmm. And by the time you got 200 pages of them, then, you know, a single comma at the beginning has given you, you know, 50 completely empty redundant pages down at the back. So I had to absolutely watch out. And everyone who worked on the book, credit to them, its editor, its copy editors, its production manager, all of these people had to headbutt with that damned column. And of course you get, you know, there's been probably three passes professionally through that for line editing and for strict grammar and punctuation, etc. Everyone, of course, has had to add the comma or the full stop. And so every time the book's come back, I've had to remove words, change words, get it all back, because the thing has suddenly pinged into 200 extra pages due to overrunning the columns.
I can imagine the track changes as well. Visually, it's hard to...
Yeah, nightmare. And you can literally have to go back 200 pages to find where it fell out. And it will be a single comma, but there isn't space for it. And so I had to go back and actually change the phraseology to make that comma fit. But of course, then it still needed another line edit because the phraseology was changed and somebody else would update it and it would go over again. Literally about three times, you know, it was affectionate. It never got to be a drag, but you know, it was some hell of a job anyway. I wouldn't do it again.
I was about to ask whether it's given you a taste for that sort of formal innovation, but maybe not that particular time.
No, I would find a different way. I did like the practice of writing in binary was very beautiful. And I could imagine how your brain very quickly adapts, certainly as the writer anyway, and hopefully the reader does adapt pretty quick. But as a writer, your mind adapts to that really well. And it would be nice to have the external narrative and an interior dialogue with a character on the other side, where you can see, you know, how divergent his intentions and his actions are, or hers are. I think that would be really interesting, but not something I'm going to do soon anyway.
People get danger money for doing the copy editing for it as well.
Yeah, I drove them crazy. Yeah, bless them. They were good. They were good as gold, and it turned out bang on. But yeah, rest assured that there is not an extra comma in anywhere in that section.
And has your approach to writing something that's non-fiction been quite different to the fiction that you write? Have you felt that has acted as any kind of constraint, or has it been quite free-flowing, creative non-fiction?
Yeah, it's been free-flowing, and it's a lovely break because I don't have to watch out for the language. And I get obsessed. I'm particularly rhythmic. I'm very musical when I write. So ultimately, although, of course, I have to say what needs to be said and it has to be clear, I spend a lot of time looking at the rhythm of the words and sentences and paragraphs, and they're very important to me. So the things like a pianola, and when I read it back, it has to play in a certain way, and I can tell when something is out of sync. And of course, in nonfiction, I don't have to worry about that. And so it makes it, it is freer and much less of a contraption. So it's been fun. Mm-hmm. But it's probably also probably led me to a new way. Now I'm going to try another novel. And it has probably led me to a new idea for that, at least in terms of the way I write, which will pay less attention to individual words and to language and rhythm and more to meaning. And simply because it was a quicker process and I think can be more genuine. So I'm going to try and write a different kind of novel and write it more simply and see how that goes. Because it would be good to, I've got a lot of ideas, but I need to move a bit more quickly if I'm going to get them all down.
Well, it'll be interesting to see when it comes out if there's a distinguishable difference for the reader in how.
Yeah, we'll see. Just dawning on me now, but you know, this last year of the apocalypse, especially, of course, is a chrysalis, and I treated it from the beginning as a chrysalis and somewhere to, you know, burrow in and make changes and get strong for the next chapters. And just occurred to me it would be good. I carry a lot of baggage on novels up to now in terms of just tics and things that are requirements for me. And if I can ditch all of that and move just clearly and swiftly to the heart of some stories, then there are some amazing stories to be told from our modern day. So I'm going to try that next, I think.
Thank you to Pierre for joining us back in March, and thank you for listening.
You can find us in all the usual podcast places or online at unsignedmethods.co.uk. Follow us on Twitter at unsignedmethods. And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
And I'm on Twitter at Jamie Batchin, on Instagram at Jamie_Batchin, and my website is jamiebatchin.com. Despite all of the terrible things that we said about social media, we have given it up and joined.
Do follow and like us.
Yeah.
Please.